Welcome to Radio Rev, podcasting from the heart of healthcare in Minneapolis, Minnesota. This is the podcast for changemakers looking to do more than just health engagement. It's about getting people to take action and do things that actually improve their health. It's a radical idea, right? So we're talking to the leaders, innovators, movers, and shakers who are bringing new ideas, inspiring others, and leading the way.
Welcome to another episode of Radio Rev. I'm your host, Jen Delwo. Thank you for joining us for another episode in our Social Determinants of Health series. As I've mentioned each week, this series dives deep into social determinants of health, offering various viewpoints on the topic with a different industry expert each week, with the hope that you take away new ideas, perspectives, and are inspired to look at SDOH in a new light from all angles. As a collective, the goal of these conversations is to inspire innovation and motivate the healthcare industry to work together to create meaningful solutions that help people live stronger, healthier lives. I'm excited to introduce our guest this week, June Simmons, President and CEO with Partners in Care Foundation, and Ray Woosley, Founding President of the Arizona Center for Education and Research on Therapeutics. June, Ray, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jen.
So I like to start with a little bit of music trivia. What's your favorite 80s song, or if you'd like, your favorite classic song?
For the 80s, I thought Chariots of Fire was an exciting, inspiring piece of music.
Well, my music has really changed with the COVID epidemic, but it's always been crazy. I'm not sure that's an 80s, but more recently it's become Staying Alive, which is an 80s, I think.
Very fitting for this time.
It is.
All right. Well, why don't we start with an introduction from both of you? If you could tell us about yourself, a bit about your career path and the work that you're doing now.
Well, thank you. I originally was trained as a social worker. I have an MSW degree, and I soon got into healthcare and gradually became a healthcare administrator and innovator. I spent a number of years working at a community teaching hospital, and then ran a visiting nurse association, and then founded Partners in Care Foundation. All of those were focused on the social determinants of health, on what happens in people's lives that lead to health impairment or injury, that impacts recovery, and with a large focus on people facing really difficult health challenges and what they can do to optimize their own outcomes in partnership with healthcare. So when we founded Partners in Care, now a 22-year-old not-for-profit, it was to build out new models of care to really help healthcare take into account the whole person using proven interventions that really enhance consumer empowerment, new behaviors for better health, and a whole set of services and resources to help people stay at home in good shape if they have disabling conditions or if they're older and facing the nursing home. So we're very interested in best health for the most people in a true partnership between community and healthcare.
That's fantastic. Thanks for that background. Ray, what about you?
Well, I began my career as a pharmacologist and worked in a small pharmaceutical company for a while, but then decided to go back to medical school and became a clinical pharmacologist studying the effects of drugs in humans. I trained in internal medicine and cardiology at Vanderbilt. Then after 13 years there, went to Georgetown University where I chaired the pharmacology department. And then, again, after 13 years, I came to Arizona as dean of the College of Medicine. I've never left my interest in, I tell people I do drugs, I've never left my interest in medications, though, and have spent most of my career finding ways to test new medicines. I was part of a study at Vanderbilt that found that some of the medicines we thought were to be saving lives were actually causing lives to be lost. So I became very interested in drug safety, and in 2000, as I moved to Arizona, I was given a federal grant to create the Arizona Center for Education and Research on Therapeutics, which focuses on drug safety and how to manage medications. So for the last 20 years, we've tried to improve the use of medicines. It was about in 2000 that the nation became aware. The Institute of Medicine came out with a report noting the large number of deaths caused by medication and medical errors. So we've been working very hard in trying to find ways to use technology to manage the vast amount of information you need to know to use prescribe and use medication safely.
So I'm particularly excited about this conversation today because the majority of our social determinants of health season has been focused on Medicaid populations, but it's really important that we not forget about Medicare when we talk about social determinants. So June, I'm going to throw this question to you. What is the SDOH impact on Medicare?
Thanks. That's a broad question. And I'll note that Partners in Care Foundation, our not-for-profit, does a lot of work around Medicaid populations, but Medicare is of great interest. For sure, the issues that we're concerned about to help people achieve optimum health and independence are universal. So being poor drives higher risks. It is a social determinant of health, but everyone has social determinants of health that impact our results in the quality of life. So whether it's food or exercise that's safe for our condition, or medications, which on here have the honor of appearing here with Dr. Woosley, because we both share a passion about medications as a major source of cure and danger. Those things, again, the form social determinants may vary by income, but even under Medicare, we can't say that everyone on Medicare, but some of them are not also Medicaid, although there are many, many Americans that are both Medicare and Medicaid, and those are among the higher risk. But perhaps even more at risk are what we call the near poor, people who aren't wealthy enough to just buy whatever they want, but people who aren't poor enough to be eligible for a lot of the rescues that can come in and help people have safe housing, food, the personal care that they need in order to remain in the community. And our focus, of course, is in the home, what happens in the home. And so we are very interested in Medicare. And we also notice that when we people on Medicaid, many of whom who have Medicare, we drive down costs by addressing the social determinants of health. We make sure they have all the essentials they need to be safe, well-fed, well-housed, well-cared for in the community, and that they have the medications that they need. Guess who saves the most money is Medicare, because when you address social determinants of health for everybody, you help people avoid getting issues or complications that are both represent suffering and distress, because no one likes to be sick or injured, but they also drive people to urgent solutions, the emergency room, the hospital, the nursing home, all of which are much more expensive. So one impact of social determinants on Medicare is if we don't address them, the cost of Medicare goes way up. Medicare is beginning to transform in face of that. There are now some small glimmers of hope that they're going to permit integrating social and community solutions with medical solutions. Because as you know, 98% of care occurs at our own hand in our home. 2% occurs in the hospital, in the physician office. And so we think it's very, very important to Medicare and the people who have Medicare to really address these major drivers of health outcomes. And I will notice, we'll discuss a little more, that medications is critical to that.
Ray, I'm going to pass this question to you. A big piece of our conversation today is about MedAdherence and medication. How is medication connected to social determinants of health?
I've learned a lot about this working with June, and so it's opened my eyes to an entirely new universe. Medications, I've always known, and I've seen firsthand, that the cost of medications can really be a deterrent to their safe use, and people will break pills in half that shouldn't be broken in half to get some of the medications into their body. But the social environment, whether they can pay for pills, whether they can see well enough to read the tiny print that's on their labels, and how they manage their medications, and how they don't comply to therapy that complex and sometimes rushed at them in an office visit. So the environment in which we take the medicines is just as important as the medicines themselves. And we take, the elderly take enormous amounts of medications. One of the things that happens as you grow older is you have multiple medical problems, and the pharmaceutical industry has done a wonderful job of finding drugs for just about everything. And that means that when people have many problems, they usually take a lot of medicines. And, you know, the national average for any person is 12 prescriptions per year. And the national, if you're over age 65, the average is 17 prescriptions per year. And most people over 65 are taking at least 5 or 6 medicines continually. Well, in the very elderly, some of the ones that we've been studying with June, they're taking 10 to 20 medicines at a time. And they're not being able to manage those well because of the social environment in which they're trying to take those medicines. The cost of medicines was addressed with Medicare Part D, which I think was 2006, where Medicare would start providing medications, which is good, but it just adds to the large number. And we know that every time, if you're taking 2 medicines, there's a chance for an interaction. If you're taking 20 medicines, there's a guarantee that they're going to interact and cause potential harm to the body, to the patient. So a lot of medicines can provide benefit, but the way you use them can be affected by your environment and your ability to manage them. And most people can't manage them. So what we've been working with June is to see if we can't combine technologies to help people manage their medications and help care providers manage the way they prescribe and monitor medication use.
You know, I'm assuming some of these interactions have an impact on SDOH and what those interactions of medications can do. So I'd like to hear if you have some examples of how medications impact SDOH or vice versa.
Interactions that occur are usually caused by whether you're taking a medicine or not. Just if you're unable to afford some of your medicines and you stop taking them, a medicine that had been interacting with another can actually start causing problems that had been prevented by the other medication. So the ability to take medicines regularly, I think, is probably, and accurately, is probably the most influence of the social determinants of health. And then just the complex biology takes over after that. Whether you trust the prescription often determines whether you're going to take it. Sometimes that trust is part of the placebo response and helps you respond to medicines. But the ability to manage these interactions, most pharmacy systems and doctors' prescribing systems have alerts to tell you of these many drug interactions, but the data show that doctors and pharmacists don't trust these, and 95% of those warnings and alerts are just clicked right on by and are ignored.
So, as we know, medications are one of the number one drivers of health outcomes for people who are facing health challenges. And there are, as Dr. Woosley notes, a few themes to the issues. Of course, one is that people may see different providers who prescribe to some degree without knowledge of what else the person has, especially if they go in the hospital. We do a lot of work to see people in the home at least once after they leave the hospital. They had meds before they went in the hospital. They go in the hospital, they're given a new set of meds to take home with them. Might be the same kind of med, but a different name, shape, and color. And often they'll go home and take them all, what they had before and what they have now, and you get a very high prevalence rate. 25% of the people we see have what we call therapeutic duplication, where without knowing it, they're taking multiple versions of the same kind of class of drug, and it can be quite harmful. So if their blood pressure meds are doubled up, it's going to have a big effect, or any other kinds of classes of drugs. So that's one, is just the lack of coordination. And a related one is the lack of full understanding of what your meds are for, how they you should be taking them, and why it matters. You know, whether people are low income, they start cutting their dose in half, which ruins its efficacy, or they're low income and they don't eat much. We had a woman who lost some of her appetite due to depression, but also was poor, and she's supposed to take her meds with food. So because she only eats lunch, she takes all her meds at noon. So she takes multiple doses of the same medication all at the same time that are supposed to be spread out. That's very harmful. So as Dr. Woosley would say, you have to take the right meds in the right way. If you take the wrong meds in the right way, you'll hurt yourself. If you take the right meds in the wrong way, you're going to hurt yourself, because they're such an important tool. So I think understanding, so that people can self-manage appropriately, is really another, you know, social determinants are about behaviors, health behaviors, among other things. But a gentleman who was worried about his memory slipping a little bit, so he took all his meds in the morning, multiple blood pressure doses, sleeping pills. It's really hard to have a good day when you're taking all your sleeping pills when you wake up in the morning.
Right.
So I think the ability to access care that's really coordinated and get a centralized record of all your meds is crucial. I think understanding and knowing how to take them, and then being able to really be able to do that, affording the medications, having an ability to get them refilled, to get them to your home. Under COVID, we have more delivery systems than we used to, but for a long time it's been the case people maybe just could not access those meds. Now we have some meds that pharmacists are very suspicious and won't give you. So a lot of complicating factors that we consider fall under the social determinants of health that drive these challenging outcomes.
Right. So we've talked a little bit about the challenges. So now I'd like to hear about the Home Meds program, some of the results and success stories you've seen.
Yeah, I love to talk about the Home Meds program of Partners in Care Foundation. It's a very mature program that's based on research. Unlike Dr. Woosley's work, it is based on non-medical personnel that can serve as detectives to go into the home and identify what we call the truth about medicine, so that medications, so that we can take a full comprehensive report to the prescribers, to the physicians, to the nurse practitioners, to the pharmacists, about what is really happening in the home. Because people, as we described, sometimes have conflicting meds from various prescribers, but they also have over-the-counter meds you're taking pain meds or sleeping pills and you think you're going to also take Tylenol PM, or you're taking things that interact improperly with some of your prescribed meds, this is important to know. So the home meds sends a social worker or a community health worker into the home, sits down and goes through the meds, what they are, goes with the person to the refrigerator, goes to the bathroom, looks by the lazy boy, by the bed, and really figures out really what is it that people actually have and are taking and how are they taking them. That's how we find the guy who's on insulin, and we find out when he was in the hospital, he was taught how to take insulin. They showed him with an orange. They had him inject the orange, and so he'd learn how to do an injection of insulin. He goes home, it's not working. The insulin isn't working. Well, it turns out when you sit at the kitchen table, you can find out, oh, he's still injecting the orange and eating it. He's supposed to be injecting himself. So this ability to go in and actually discover all the vitamins, the supplements, the foreign meds, the prescribed meds, the old meds, the current meds, get a record of that electronically and interview the person for signs and symptoms of adverse meds response. We look for dizziness, confusion, history of recent falls. We look for differing self-reported blood pressure sitting and standing. We put all this into a software and it will alert up if there are particular issues that look like they should be reviewed. And that goes to a pharmacist who screens it and then forwards it on to the prescriber so that we can correct the things that are quite dangerous. 77% with falls risk in the home, much of which is caused by some of the medications people are taking. We follow people home from the hospital very often to reduce avoidable readmissions. And by looking at the home and coaching the person to get to their physician for follow-up and gathering these meds, we find we can reduce the return to the hospital for complications that are avoidable. We reduce these readmissions and this avoidable suffering by 40 to 70%. It's an amazing reduction in people getting worse, feeling bad, reaching out, getting to the ER, getting admitted to the hospital. So those kinds of findings, I think, are very powerful. And that's what Home Meds does.
Yeah, that's incredible. So you've clearly outlined the critical importance of community health workers to the success of this program. And you may have already answered this question, but can you talk a bit more about the role that community health workers play to ensure SDOH barriers are addressed in the population you serve?
You bet. And it's a new title to hear about in healthcare. So I think it represents a bold innovation. You know, typically in America, we've gone to the hospital, we've gone to the ER, we've gone to the doctor. And we've been seen, we've been diagnosed, treated, recommendations, and they send us out on our own. Now we're trying to transform medicine into a more insightful consumer group with more support when they do go back to the home. So often you don't need a nurse or a doctor or pharmacist to drive to the home to see what's going on in the home, but someone needs to go. Here's an alternative workforce whose specialty is gaining the trust of the person enough that they're willing to let us into the home. So we can go in and sit and down and really talk through what people are faced with. We can observe the realities that are there and bring these important issues about what is either going to enhance or what is undermining the health and safety of the person in the home. We don't have enough nurses anyway, or enough doctors. So this extending workforce, social workers, community health workers who have lesser in education, these are all a full array of newly available trained workforce who can work with decision support tools to do a full assessment of, is it a safe home environment? what's going on with the meds, what are the health impacting self-care behaviors, and really bring that into a full partnership. So healthcare is really looking at a real person with real knowledge. We had a woman who kept falling and was injuring herself, and healthcare didn't know what's going on there. She didn't really know how to identify the source, but when the community health worker went in and sat at the kitchen table with her, they realized that the chairs in her kitchen had wheels. And it was the instability of those chairs flipping and ending up with her falling that was critical. Some people have a lot of other problems. We saw one that had adaptive walker that was broken, so they weren't using it. And so a lot of issues around adapting the home environment. We see a lot of things that if they're addressed, they're affordable and simple to address. Lack of food, lack of safe environment, that can be solved and keep people safe, keep costs down, keep suffering down.
The work you're doing is so interesting and so innovative. I just love hearing about it. So thank you for sharing. Speaking of innovations, what are you both seeing in the industry that excites you?
You won't believe this answer, but it's true. Honestly, the most exciting innovation that I've come across in 30 or 40 years of research is the ability to work with June and find out what medicines people are taking. I spent more than 20 years trying to develop pharmacogenetic testing, the human genome's promise that the medicines, you take the right medicine at the right time, for the right reason. And all of this personalized medicine that people have talked about, I couldn't tell if it was personalized because I didn't know what people were taking. So I'm really excited about the ability to find out for the first time what someone is taking and why, because then I can find out, is it helping them or hurting? And that's just the beginning. We looked at community health centers and prescribing of drugs and what was actually being taken. And we found that people don't often tell you everything they're taking. They're embarrassed by it. They don't want to say they're on an antidepressant. They don't want to say that they're taking a medicine for herpes or something like that. We found that 40% of the medicines that the medical record thought were being taken were not, and that another 40% of medicines that were not in the medical record were actually being taken. So I think the real world environment that June's people work in and the factors that they're addressing are the most exciting to me. Now, I'll admit I'm a gadget nut, and some of the things like home monitoring of your EKG, where you can simply take something about the size of a credit card and let it record your electrocardiogram, is going to change everything we're doing. But without the other very important things of knowing which medicines you're taking and where your medical records are, how do you manage all this information? Clinical decision support tools like home meds and ones that we're developing at AZ CERT are going to be essential in helping doctors and caregivers and patients manage their medications and their health care. So I think technology will make a big difference, but I think just the practical aspects of the real world of medical care that are being addressed with home meds and by partners are some of the most exciting innovations for me.
That's a knockout, isn't it? I love that. Thank you, sir. Well, to me, one thing that's really driving a great deal is that we live in a technological age and we have the ability to measure results and causes. And so measurement, I think, has been a force, and you can hear Dr. Woosley is a king of measurement. It has led us to even have this conversation because it has led to the recognition of social determinants of health. It's only in the last several years that this has become common language. And look, now you're abbreviating it, SDOH. We all know what that means.
Right.
Several decades waiting for that to be the case. So to me, That's a bold innovation, and it leads us then to where we have been so interested for so long, which is to see what really happens at home, where most health is fashioned for good or for ill. And so pulling those together and finding healthcare beginning to look at really partnering with community-based organizations like ours is, to really look at, do people have enough food? Do they have a safe environment where they're not going to trip and fall? Do they have access to the right medicine? Those are massively important. And then that has led us also to a big focus on evidence-based health self-management programs that have been available increasingly in the community so people can learn how to succeed caring for themselves and their families. But the latest is emerging under COVID, because now we can't go to the home at this time. I mean, not safely, not readily, not frequently. And we live in an age of technology. So it's been very exciting to see all across the country and certainly all across our organization, the development of new virtual interventions for medicine and for community. Telehealth, you can get your doctor to look at you on Zoom. You can reach out for help and don't even have to drive somewhere, and no one has to drive to you. So we're protecting the environment at the same time. So I think this ability to take a lot of these resources, we've been building workshops for people to learn how to manage their diabetes, their hypertension, their falls risk, and having them drive to those workshops. Now we're putting those workshops in Zoom on two-way television delivery and letting people connect who now may be too isolated under COVID. They can connect and see each other with these new kinds of rather affordable devices. So it's a big move to overcome the digital divide and really connect us in bold new ways using all we've and are learning about new results through these changes in tools to help people and to help people help themselves.
Definitely. COVID has pushed all of us to innovate and try new things and do things differently.
It's amazing.
I love that you mentioned that. So my last question for both of you, which might be a challenge to answer because we are quarantining right now, what's the coolest thing each of you has done lately?
Well, if the only good thing I can think about COVID is the fact that our son has had to stay at home with us for the last couple of months. And the coolest part of that was our every night sitting down at the TV to play Jeopardy together. So,
oh, fun.
So there are some good things that have come out of this for us. And I've gotten to know my dog better than ever before.
Is that a good thing?
That's a very good thing.
Okay. Great. How about you, June?
Well, those are great things, Ray. And I know that you know that the animal shelters are empty because everybody's been adopting. We did transition 175 staff members to work from home virtually overnight. So that was amazing. But on the personal side, I must say it's a beautiful spring here, and I'm very proud of the roses that I've been able to cut every day and keep flowers all around the house, and have some very good success with a little more gardening around the house.
That's great. Well, thank you both so much for this conversation today. This has been awesome, and I think our listeners are really going to love it. So thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Jen.
Thanks for joining us for the Radio Rev podcast brought to you by Revel. If you found today's conversation as informative and energizing as we did, please take a moment and subscribe to the podcast. As always, we invite you to learn more about us and check out all of our content at revel-health.com/radiorev.